Hello, Capital District. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the beautiful Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunling.
And I'm Kayla Danks. Today we start off by talking with Richard Webster about the proposed Catskill incinerator ash dump.
Then we have another food diary with Amy Halloran interviewing Tracy Frisch.
And later on, we have the second part of Willie Terry's report from the recent Climate and Environmental Justice Forum in Albany.
Then we hear from singer Claire Promise and photographer Rayon Kazanecki about One Rhyme at a Time.
Finally, we talk with Maureen Ahmad from Women Against War about our taxes and military spending. But first, some rapid-fire headlines.
The Times Union reports that Troy's fifth attempt to get something built at One Monument Square relies heavily on the state renewing expired grants that affect Riverfront Park as well as the development of the former City Hall site. Assemblymember John McDonald and State Senator Neil Breslin have brought back one $2 million grant for an extra year and are working to secure another $1.4 million.
Governor Andrew Cuomo said on Tuesday that he doesn't have any specific environmental goals for the final 8 weeks of the legislative session. This has raised concerns since nothing was done on climate change in the recent state budget. The governor also limited the traditional Earth Day announcement to signing the recently passed statewide ban on plastic bags 2 years after the governor and lawmakers took the unusual step of blocking New York City's plastic bag law from going into effect.
State Democrats are planning to push the presidential primary back to April 28, 2020. With so many Democrats seeking the party's national nomination, state party officials hope that the later date will increase the state's role in selecting the eventual candidate. Under the national party rules, New York gets more delegates from 246 up to 327 for delaying its decision, its election.
In hopes of killing a proposed Albany County ban on flavored e-cigarettes, vaping advocates rallied on Tuesday, arguing that vaping saves lives. Advocates stated that vaping helps cigarette smokers quit tobacco and that taking away their flavors will destroy the effectiveness of e-cigarettes. They say vaping is more effective than other tobacco replacement products in helping people quit. Opponents argue, however, that flavored vapes are marketed to teens and can lead them to future cigarette use. The National Institute for Drug Abuse noted a 30.7% of teens that used e-cigarettes started smoking traditional cigarettes within 6 months.
Member of the IUE CWA Local 301 union rallied outside General Electric in Schenectady on Tuesday as contract talks near. The present four-year contract expires in June, and its replacement will be negotiated amid an aggressive cost and job-cutting campaign by the industrial conglomerate, especially within its troubled GE power unit. Healthcare benefits and job security are among the union's major concerns.
New York residents must upgrade their driver's licenses soon if they plan on taking domestic airplane flights. Starting in October 2020, passengers can no longer use any ordinary license as ID to go through security and board a plane. Residents will need what is called a real ID that has a star on them, indicating that they meet federal security standards.
The New York State Public Service Commission has extended by a month the time to submit public comments regarding National Grid's proposed 7.3-mile, 16-inch natural gas transmission pipeline in the town of Bethlehem, Albany County, and the town of North and East Greenbush in Rensselaer County. The new deadline is May 24th.
Local Republican elected officials, flanked by law enforcement on Wednesday at the Rensselaer County DMV, blasted the proposal that would allow undocumented immigrants to apply for and receive driver's licenses. But a counter demonstration of supporters for the legislation appeared, interrupting with songs and pushing back against claims made by the officials. At one point, the demonstrators sang, "This land is your land." That's it for the headlines.
On Tuesday night, several hundred people jammed into a community forum about Willow Brader's proposed incinerator ash dump in Catskill. We are joined now by Richard Webster, a riverkeeper. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Richard.
How are you doing?
Good. So, Richard, can you give us a brief overview of the proposal and perhaps say a few words about Riverkeeper?
protect the New York City's drinking water. So the proposal, the meeting last night is all part of that mission to both clean up existing pollution and make sure we don't have new pollution being added to the river.
And I'm sorry, so can you tell us what exactly are they planning to do at the dump?
Yeah, so basically what they're proposing to do, this is Wheelabrator. They're a huge incinerator company. They run three incinerators in the Hudson Valley. And they're proposing to take an old quarry, the Peckham Quarry in Catskill, and dump toxic ash in there to fill it up. The proposal is to put in 445,000 tons of ash per year, and they reckon it'll take 48 years to fill the place up. The ash is highly toxic. It's laden with metals like lead, mercury, cadmium, and arsenic. And the quarry is close to the river. As we heard in detail last night, the underlying geology is very porous. There's limestone. There's lots of cracks. There's lots of ways, and even Wheelabrator's own study has shown that water goes directly from the quarry down towards the river. So, obviously, one of the things we're worried about is that the metals from the ash can leach out into the water, and then the water can come down and go into the river. But that's not the only problem. There's a number of other problems with the proposal. Perhaps the most glaring is that they proposed to have a leachate collection system. So they're proposing when rain falls on the ash in the quarry, they're proposing to extract it, put it in a tank, and then truck it to the local sewage treatment plant. The problem with this is the sewage treatment plant doesn't effectively treat these kind of dissolved toxic metals. And so basically it's just like taking a pipe and putting these toxic metals straight into the Hudson.
And can you tell us what has been the response of town officials so far?
So town officials have been somewhat equivocal. They've said they're looking at the proposal. They said it might be a useful way to generate some revenue, but we're looking for them to be much more definitive and be very clear. This is absolutely not a useful way to generate revenue. The effect of this kind of proposal generally is to make the town known for its dump, to reduced ratables, and to generally make towns less desirable for other businesses. So if the desire of the town is to enhance economic development, this is absolutely the wrong way to go.
What has been the response so far of town officials to the proposal?
Well, they're keeping very quiet. Initially, there was a statement from Doreen Davis, which was slightly positive, saying this could be a useful way to generate revenue. Since then, we've heard nothing. I believe a number of town officials were at the meeting last night. I'm sure they saw and heard loud and clear from the crowd that popular opinion is that this is not the way to go. And so we're hoping for a more definitive statement soon saying that they agree with us that this is not the right approach.
And can you tell us a little bit more about Wheelabrator and what their environmental track record is like?
Sure. So Wheelabrator is a huge incinerator company. There are a number of incinerators around the country. Their track record is, shall we say, checkered at best. So, for example, in Massachusetts, they were sued, I think, by the state for environmental violations and ended up with a $7.5 million fine, which is one of the biggest ever in Massachusetts. They also have a habit of signing up rather stringent contracts. And so, for instance, in Baltimore, they cited an incinerator in a community of color. They then had a contract with the city that said that they had to put a certain amount of waste there, and the city did a good job in reducing the waste, and Wheelabrator ended up suing the city for $32 million for not sending enough waste to the incinerator. So these are not people that you want to mess around with. They generally are very hard-nosed, and we'll definitely use their resources to try to exploit local towns.
I don't know if you covered this. I had to step away for a second, but understand that there's been some games played over the years in terms of how the ash from incinerator is classified and whether it's considered toxic or hazardous and how that impacts the type on the type of, you know, landfill it should be put in order to protect residents from, you know, leakage and, you know, water contamination.
Yes, that's right. So there was some litigation about this. What was happening was under the old EPA test, incinerator ash was showing that it met the criteria for hazardous waste. The industry then sued to try to figure out, to try to get themselves an exemption for testing. They failed to get that exemption. And the Supreme Court said to the EPA, it actually went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said to the EPA, you figure out how the testing should be done. EPA then changed the leachate test, making it more lax. And basically, that ended up, once the ash, there's both fly ash and bottom ash. So once the fly ash, which is the most toxic, was combined with the bottom ash, then they were able to pass. But they're really only able to pass because the ash itself is alkaline, and so that neutralizes the acid that they use in the test. So if this stuff were hazardous waste, it would have to go to a hazardous waste landfill, which there is only one in New York State. So you know, however you test it, the bottom line is that this stuff is toxic, should be regarded as toxic, and should be treated with great care.
So what are the next steps in the review and permit process for the dump?
So in terms of the DEC process, DEC has done a pretty good job at reviewing this application carefully and has decided and written letters to Wheelabrator saying that this is the wrong place to put an ash landfill because the geology is bad, you can't monitor it, and you can't meet the bedrock separation requirements. So DEC has sent them a letter saying your application is incomplete, and so that doesn't mean that the application's over, it just means to say that it's dormant. So what we're looking to do now is to have local towns come out and clearly oppose this so that Wheelabrator thinks again and decides that this is not the right place to come and try and do this project.
Is there any particular reason why they want to try to, you know, site it in Catskill or in the neighboring area? Why did they pick this town?
Well, I think the ash is coming from three different incinerators. So it's coming from Peekskill, Poughkeepsie, and Hudson Falls. And I think probably the idea is that this is somewhat in the middle of all of those. And there is somebody with a big hole here, and they want to fill that hole. So I guess it's a meeting of the minds in that sense. But I should emphasize that this proposal to fill a quarry with ash would be the first quarry in New York State to be turned into a dump. And the reason that that is a bad idea is because, you know, years of blasting tends to make cracks and fissures develop. So quarries are a really bad place to put both waste and ash. And indeed, a number of quarries that have been filled with coal ash have caused environmental damage, and that's been documented by the EPA.
And are there any ways people can find out more information, and can they provide their input regarding the proposal?
And we have about 45 seconds.
Yes. Well, first thing, if they can email my colleague Jessica Roth, jroth@riverkeeper.org, and we are in the process of putting together a big mailing list, so we'll keep people updated. And there is a video posted, but I know not where, of the meeting last night. But if people email Jessica, she will let them know where the video is posted.
Well, thank you very much. And Richard, Riverkeeper website?
It's www.riverkeeper.org.
Oh, that's an easy one. Thank you very much, Richard, for taking
Wonderful.
Your time.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
All the best. Bye.
So up next, Amy Halloran is the food security manager at Unity House, and she's a Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent, and she's going to speak with Tracy Frisch about the beginnings of the farmer's market.
Hi, I'm Amy Halloran, and I'm here with another food diary. I want to talk today about the beginnings of the Troy Waterfront Farmers Market with Tracy Frisch. Tracy, welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, good. I'm really excited to share with our listenership some of this beginning. I mean, it's on its 20th year,
yes.
So you were there right at the start. What did that start look like?
Well, let's see. It was several years into the Regional Farm and Food Project, which I was part of starting and which I ran for about 8 or 9 years. Before that, we had a sustainable community network, and once a year we had this big harvest dinner that people did. And the first one, we had no idea. There was a handful of us doing it, and 90 people showed up. And so out of that came the Regional Farm and Food Project, where we actually worked with a lot of farmers, and we were also promoted local foods. So the farmers market was kind of a no-brainer. But what happened is we started a radio show on WRPI, and once a month there would be two or three of us, and we did interviews, and we had news and all that for an hour. And a young professor at Siena College called us up, because we gave the phone number for the organization, and he said, we just moved here from Minnesota, and we really like the farmers markets that we've seen in Vermont. Why isn't there anything in Albany or Troy? And we said, oh, funny. He didn't call the radio station. He might have called afterwards. And we're like, well, funny you should ask about that, because we're working with farmers, and some of them are talking about how there aren't any good markets for them to go to. So we started a group, and we met every month, and we did research, and there were a lot of differences in opinion of what we should do. We also, one of the first things we did is we visited several markets, and we found out some people went to Saratoga and some people went to one in Albany maybe, but we found out that the ones in Albany, which is where we originally set our sights, were not producer only. So people would go to the Menands Market, the wholesale market where things are shipped from everywhere, as well as some of the local, the farmers in the greater capital region bring their stuff to sell at like 5 or 6 in the morning to restaurants and stores and others who have often prearranged for them to bring stuff to buy, to sell to them, like Honest Weight Food Co-op has historically gone there. Anyway, so we like, okay, we want a producer-only farmers market, which means that only farmers can only bring what they have grown, not what they bought from North Carolina or California at a wholesale market. So that was the first thing that made a difference. And so we met, and different people showed up, different farmers came. We had one farmer from Rensselaer County, I think a vegetable grower, who wanted to have a public market, which would have been a really difficult thing, because farmers would have to be there every day of the week. And that would be indoors. It would be a very expensive, big proposition. I mean, there's many public markets that are historic that have been going on for 100 or more years. The Amish, the Pennsylvania Dutch markets, are well known in Pennsylvania. So anyway, we're meeting like every month, and several months into it, Tom Carroll from the Hudson Mohawk Gateway, is that Industrial Gateway, a former RPI professor, showed up with the woman who then ran the visitor center for Troy. And they said, we heard about you guys and we want a farmer's market in Troy.
Carol LaCivita.
Okay, well, maybe. I cannot remember. So they said, we can help you. We can get the design studio, the students at RPI, to look at sites and do designs for them. So we were like, wow, that's really great. Because we also, at the same time, we had the business improvement district, I think, at Lark Street, saying, why don't you come to Lark Street? And we're like, and we'll close the street down. It's like, we're going to have a lot of enemies before we start. So we were a little less interested in that. But the Troy thing, so the students worked on their designs. And then probably in April or May, about 8 of us followed around the students and went to maybe 5 or 6 sites. and saw their plans, and we chose one site. And we had one person in the group who really wanted a different site, but we chose the waterfront site at, near the Headley Building. And then, but it was already, you know, it was too late in the season to start. So we didn't open for another year. We, people started meeting with the Headley management team and looking at signage from with the city. And we were assigned, some, the city assigned someone to work with us. And I don't remember her name either. And we started recruiting farmers. We had a press conference at one point, and we had media there. And the farmers who were there were never actually ended up being in the farmers market. They found other ways to vend, but you know, it got us on the map. And then the next year, we started the market, and we're right next to the Riverfront Cafe. Does that still exist?
No. I'm not a good record on that.
Okay. Well. Okay. In any case, the chef owner of that, I remember
George.
George. I remember him coming to the market like a month or two after we started. It was a cold spring, and people did not have a lot of produce because it was very cold. Maybe I don't remember if it was rainy. We had people come in and say, "Where are the tomatoes? Why don't you buy tomatoes somewhere and bring them? We want tomatoes." And he said, "Well, I think maybe this would work in Niskiona or Clifton Park, but I don't think we're ready for it in Troy." But we hung in there, and within a year, people were really ready for it. And the first year, we had a work-study student for an extension agent who's now a full-time farmer, who was the market manager, and she would collect the payments every day, every Saturday from the farmers, and maybe tell them a few things. So, you know, and then the next year,
da-na-na-na,
we started meeting people that I had never heard of this before, but they were, like Troy Boosters. What was the name?
Yes, they had a specific name.
Maybe like Trojan.
Troy Boosters or something.
Yes. So I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And then we met Amy.
And
she became our first real farmer's market manager. And that was a real boost. And that lifted the market up a notch. But it was and then within a year, we had a winter market that a lamb producer,
Donna Mullen,
yes,
took the initiative and made that happen
right at the Troy Atrium, mm-hmm. and that's
where
been going
is.
Ever since. So,
yep.
But I would say the thing that made this market really different is that we started with a very big vision. We're not like, just let's do a market tomorrow. We're like, let's think it over, and we always had community people on the market board. Because it wasn't just about farmers, it was about the community. We always were kind of somewhat careful in selecting vendors, so we had a good mix. And, you know, we wanted to keep things civil and upbeat between people, and we also stressed promotion.
And creating an invitation. I mean, I think it's been those structures that you set in place,
yes,
they really paid off,
yeah,
because it's a huge economic,
yeah, so
driver.
It's been very exciting to watch Troy change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also really fun when I'm like, oh, so what did I do with the Regional Farm and Food Project? Well, I can't say. Well, we did educational programs for farmers. Well, that's kind of obtuse to people. Oh, we started the Troy Farmers Market. And people go, oh, okay.
Now I see it.
So, it was a really fun project. And I wish I could get there more often, but I now live about 34 miles to the north in Washington County. So it's kind of hard to get there on very often at all.
But you sure made something great happen. And thank you for being on the radio to
yeah,
draw that idea in. I think it's a nice irony that here we are on the radio
right, again.
To talk about its beginnings. Tracy, thank you so much.
Well,
for
thank
talking
you. I'm
about
glad
it.
To, because I didn't even realize it was the 20th year because I had forgotten what year it started.
That's great. Tracy Frisch, thank you for joining me. This has been Amy Halloran, Food Security Manager at Unity House, with another Food Diary.
And that was Amy Halloran with Tracy Frisch speaking about the beginning of the farmers market. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 on weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. Willie Terry attended the Environmental and Climate Justice for Puerto Rico to Albany Forum on Saturday, April 13th at the Capital District Latino Center. In this segment, you will hear part two of his interviews with Willie White, Ceci Alfonso, and Kat Perez.
Terry, WOOC, Roman Labor Correspondent, and I'm here at the Environmental and Climate Justice from Puerto Rico to Albany Forum at the Latino Community Center. And I have one of the speakers that I'm going to talk to just for a couple of minutes, Willie White. He's from the South End, and he's the South End leader and founder of A Village?
Yes, sir.
All right. What is A Village?
So A Village is a grassroots organization that was founded in 2009. We are a group that advocate for justice, for equal rights, for environmental rights. So A Village kind of fights on many different fronts. But I'm not with A Village anymore. I am now the new executive director of My Brothers and Sisters Keepers here in Albany, New York.
So tell me something, just a little about yourself and how you got involved in these social justice issues.
Okay, so I'm a young man from Tupelo, Mississippi. Came to Albany when I was very young, 7 to 8 years old, and my dad brought me here, went through school here, worked many jobs. And then all of a sudden, I asked myself, what can I do in my community to help move my community forward in a positive way? I had major back surgery in 2001, 2004, and 2008. After recuperating, I got up and I read two books. I read The Audacity of Hope and Dreams from My Father, both written by our former president, Barack Obama. And those books inspired me, and inspired me to start A Village. A Village was started to get ordinary people involved from the community, people who didn't have to have special degrees or special be a VIP or anything, just ordinary people can come in and make a difference in their community. And I put that message out in the community, and people came. So I started A Village in 2009. We had a meeting on August 6, 2009, and I just resigned about 3 months ago. After 10 years of working with A Village, you know, the community taught me that, you know, we can do things. We just have to come together as a people. So that's what kind of sparked me to be a community activist. And it's in my blood now. I couldn't get rid of it if I wanted to.
All right. Your presentation here at the conference today.
Sure.
Right. What were some of the major points that you were trying to bring out?
So Ezra Prentice is a predominantly black community located next door to the Port of Albany. They're in the middle of 787. They're next door to a recycling plant, next door to the county waste. And their front yard is 1,000 diesel trucks that go through their community every single day. In their backyard is the bomb trains that sit idle in their backyard, spewing out environmental toxic air into the community. And so, I said to myself, if this was a white community, would this be allowed to happen at such a vast way and in such a vast way? And I said, no. I answered my question, no. A white community would not stand for this. Now, one of the things that happens in our community, we don't have the means to stand up and fight. And what I mean by that a lot of people at Ezra Prentice will not stand up and fight because they're afraid that they're going to get kicked out of their apartment because it's public housing. More white people have the means to stand up and fight. They have the economic means, and they have the numbers and people in their community who will stand up and fight, who can stand up and fight and not fearing anything else. So Ezra Prentice people are dismayed by what's happening down there, but they are afraid to come out and fight. And that's why my voice is elevated in a way where I'll speak for them. If they can't get out, I'll get out for them. And I will continue to fight this fight. Not just me. There's a lot of community partners who are helping fight this fight. I think of people like Tom McFeeters from the community. I think of Dr. Stacy Pettigrew from the community, Dominic Castellero. There's so many people who are willing to stand up and help these people fight the fight that needs to be fight. But one thing that we all will call for is for the governor to come and take some action in our community, because ultimately he has the power to make change down at Ezra Prentice.
Right. Yeah. And I noticed also when you speak, you were talking a lot about Martin Luther King. And
for
you,
sure.
And at the end, you gave a quote.
Right.
There's a quote about him.
Sure.
So just give me that famous quote again.
So Dr. King said, "I've been to the mountaintop. I've looked over and I've seen the promised land." He said, "I might not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. You see, I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man, because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. And when there's justice reached by the people of Ezra Prentice, we will know that we're at the promised land at that time, because those people deserve to breathe clean air. They are victimized by the very air that they breathe. There's racism in dirty air. There's racism in breathing, breathing while black. So how many people in this world can say that it is okay for human habitation to live next to the Port of Albany, to live in an industrial area where we know that there is toxic air? Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
And thank
That's
you.
That's the key.
All right. Thank you, Willie White.
Thank you, sir. Thank right. you.
And now I have the MC of the program, Ceci Alfonso, who's a board member for the Citizen Action Committee, right?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm a board member for Citizen Action, which is a community-based organization that it's been active for 35 years, and it takes on social, economic, political issues that impact the community. That's why it's called Citizen Action, because we practice what we preach. And currently, we are very aware of the need to connect the dots between the environmental injustice that's happened to individuals who happen to be Puerto Ricans.
Right, that's why we're going to ask you, you know, how did you come up with this particular topic to organize and all been around this?
Well, when we talk about environmental injustice, you cannot, and you live in the area, in the Capital District, you realize that in the poor black and Latino communities, there is a higher than normal incidence of individuals, children in particular, with asthma. And that because historically there has been a large Latino community in the Capital District, when Maria hit, And Latinos, Puerto Ricans in particular, had to leave the island, many of them came up here. And in particular, they came to Amsterdam, they came to the Capital District. And I can say, as a member of Citizen Action's board, when I approached them about us being a place where we can gather emergency food, clothes, supplies, and the word went out to the members of the Citizen Action, the response was monumental. And it showed that there is an active community here, not only involved in the struggle for environmental justice and supported by the larger progressive white community, but also connecting Puerto Ricans, Latinos, and the progressive community. So it just felt like we had to do something.
Right. Now, for anyone who's thinking about getting involved in this issue, what advice would you have for them?
What I would say is please join Citizen Action. It is a membership organization. It has effectively fought and won many of the rights that the disenfranchised and people of color community deserves. For example, we fought for $15 an hour as a minimum wage, and I have to say proudly that we, among many, feel like we contributed to that. We recently, the state legislator agreed to eradicate cash bail. That is something that Citizen Action put their hearts and energy into, and I can say very proudly again that we made a difference in that.
And how do one get involved there?
Well, Citizen Action is located on 94th Central Avenue, and I, Ceci, can be reached at Citizen Action. My email address is 5 Ceci, that's CeSSIEALF 123@gmail.com. I would give you the number right now, but I don't have it off the top of my head. So, but thank you very much for spreading the word.
All right, and thank you, Ceci. And to the radio audience, get involved. All right, I'm still here at the Environmental Conference, and they just had a meal, and they said that it was a taste of Puerto Rico. And I have one of the person who was working on that, and her name is...
My name is Kat Perez. Kat Perez.
Oh, Kat Perez. And Kat Perez, you're part of Citizen Action?
I'm part of Capital District Latinos.
Oh, okay. That's the organization who housed the conference. Okay. And Kat, what is some of the food that you had that we had today?
Yeah, so we said if we're going to host this event here at Capital District Latinos, then we must have Latino food. So we have from the restaurante, Lo Nuestro Restaurant, right on Central Avenue. And then we have from Moliendo Cafe, which is a Colombian restaurant. And then Lo Nuestro Restaurant is Dominican. So you have a taste of Dominican food and Colombian.
Okay. Oh, not Puerto Rican?
It's not Puerto Rican.
Okay. But anyway, it was good.
Thank you. Thank you. So we try to have healthy foods. We try to have a variety of, if you could eat meat, you could have pork, chicken. But if you were a vegetarian or vegan, you could also eat what we have here. Because myself, I'm a vegetarian / vegan. So, yes.
All right. Thank you.
No problem.
So that was Willie Terry, who was covering the climate and environmental justice conference. And who was he speaking to?
And he was speaking with Willie White, Ceci Alfonso, and Kat Perez. For our next segment, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce speaks with singer Claire Promise and photographer Rayanne Zarnecki about One Rhyme at a Time, an event in Albany celebrating the healing power of the arts.
Hey, how are you? Happy to be here. This event is pretty special to me. It's called One Rhyme at a Time. Basically, to break free of the stigmas and the stereotypes of anything to do with mental illness, addiction, any type of struggle that people go through, and how we overcome these obstacles in life through the arts.
Okay, and how did you get the inspiration? Well, first, tell us a bit about you. You're an artist. You're producing this. What are you all about?
Well, I've been performing since I was 6 years old. I've been in the music industry pretty much my whole life. I've also struggled with mental illness myself. I battled with addiction. I'm in recovery now. These things have all... touched home with me. And going through the years, I've been to a lot of, as a woman, I've been to a lot of showcases where I was never heard, where, you know, was never be able to get my own time slot due to like the guys and just chauvinistic things. I've dealt with reverse racism, a lot of just stereotypes and labels. It doesn't have to necessarily be the two that I'm speaking about. I'm just speaking about those two because those are the two that I deal with. And that's why you said it wasn't on the flyer, because it's basically one rhyme at a time. It's one rhyme at a time because I do music and that's how I get through life. Music has gotten me through my obstacles one rhyme at a time. It's kind of like taken from the one day at a time slogan in NAAA, whatever you'd like to say, you know. But that's basically a way that I get through life. And whatever way people choose to get through life in their type of arts, a lot of times people that deal with those types of struggles do are musicians. And, you know, they said Albert Einstein was crazy, you know, but he's a genius. So, you know.
So tell us what to expect at the event.
Well, you can expect a whole lot of everything. It's not just one such thing. There's going to be a couple designers and a fashion show. Shout out to Tierra Conklin and Sean Delaney. We've got people performing from California, Massachusetts, all to be at this positive event. We've got local musicians, Kettlewell. We've got local rappers. We've got comedians. We've got dancers. We've got singers such as myself. We've got motivational speakers. The legendary DJ Albi is going to be speaking. I mean, it's a lot of everything. There's going to be vendors, which is she's the co-director of that side, so she can speak on that. It's everything because the arts has no limit.
So we're speaking with performing artist Claire Promise, and she's joined here in the studio by Rayanne Sarnecki.
That's correct. Yeah, we're going to have some vendors there also. A lot of people who deal with mental health or addiction express themselves through painting, photography. So we want to represent them. We're going to have a couple people with painting. They make jewelry makers. It's just the arts seem to be a real outlet for people who are struggling with things in their life. And I myself, you know, have been in recovery and in recovery, and I chose photography. I like to deal with black and white photography. I like to catch the moment. I do a lot of videos. I do videos for Claire, a lot of videos for artists, music artists. And I do documentaries, and I had worked 25 years and decided after retiring that it was my time to do what I wanted to do. So I went back to school and got my associate's degree in photography. So I'm finding a niche to do that. But we, you know, the vendors are basically people who are expressing their feelings through their art also.
And tell us a bit about the venue.
The venue is at the Albany Barn. It's a nonprofit organization. They actually... it's like awesome that I'm having it there. I actually reside there, as does Rayanne.
Yeah, we both do.
Yeah, we both do. They put this building. Well, the building was an old school, but they made it into an art building. It's from a building for all artists, and they put it there to just help the community, to try to bring that piece of community some love and some change. And you know, I just feel so blessed and honored to be a part of that and to be able to bring this type of piece of event, which has never been brought there before, in this building is kind of, I think, groundbreaking.
It's the old St. Joseph's School, if people are familiar with Albany and Arbor Hill, which is a community that needs some revitalization where we are. I mean, it's not the best neighborhood, but I think we bring a lot to the neighborhood as far as with the arts being right there. On one side of the building is the commercial side, which is where the event will be. The other side of the building is the Academy Lofts, where you have to either be an artist or someone involved in the arts to apply to live there.
So. Yeah.
And how did you get involved with the barn? How did that? How did it come to be the venue for your performance?
Well, I live there. So
it makes it
a little easier to go over and say, hey, can I do an event here? You know, I love everyone that works there, and we reside there. And it's just the building you know, is there to bring love into the community. And it just, the the focus of the event fits purpose into the why the building is even there. You know what I mean? So I wouldn't want it at any other place. I wouldn't want it at like a club or something because it's not that type of event.
Great. And the tickets are available on our Eventbrite.
Yep, go to, if you, yep, tickets, thank you for,
the tickets are on sale yes, now, thank you. Yep. So
thank you for bringing that up.
$15 through Eventbrite or $20 at the door.
Yep, go to One Rhyme at a Time on Facebook, and that's the event page, and you can click on the book now, and it'll take you right to Eventbrite, and you can get them, and also Eventbrite.com, you can put in One Rhyme at a Time, and you can buy the tickets there as well.
We will be having refreshments, raffles, gift bags,
door prizes. We have a lot of sponsors in the making, so don't miss out.
So if I've got all this right, because there's a lot going on, it's an event at the barn in downtown Albany. It's in May 23rd. It's going to be featuring you, Claire Promise, singing with many other artists, and our other guest, Rayanne Sarnecki is organizing a resource table and merchandise.
Yes, well, we also plan on having some people from some organizations. We wanted to try to get AIDS testing and some other other things available for people who are there.
Team Hope in our own voices are trying to get on board. So,
and the whole thing is a benefit for mental health organizations.
No, it's not. It's not really a benefit. It's to show how we express ourselves, because sometimes a lot of artists don't know how to express themselves, and the only way that they can is through the arts. So people that struggle on a daily basis, that's how we do it. You know what I mean? This is how we do it, and that's how we create greatness. You know what I mean? That's how music is made. It's through pain. It's through love. It's through this. And you can't really feel music unless it's through an emotion or through art or whatever you say. So that's basically how we're doing it. We're letting the world see all brought together of like, you know, just like, this is how we express ourselves. This is the struggles we go through. We're going to have motivational speaking and how music or the arts have helped people do that, sort of for people like you that don't really understand what this event is about. That's what the motivational speakers are there for, to sort of touch base on that.
Well, and I think to a lot of people who do deal with mental health or struggle with addiction have a hard time. They're very great artists. They're great entertainers, but they don't know how to move over to another part of life, you know, to the part of life where maybe they want to produce their music, or they don't have the ability to get their stuff out there. So it's a platform for the people who don't have the ability or the knowledge on getting heard.
Right, to
so
be
we
heard.
So we want people who are struggling and everything to know that there are people out there interested in what they're doing, whether they're singing or painting or whatever, what you're doing, we want people to notice what you're doing.
Exactly. Everyone needs to be heard. Everyone is equal. And everyone needs a chance to shine.
Great. So it's an evening celebrating the healing power of the arts.
Yes. There we go.
And getting people in touch.
Put that on our flyer.
Yes, I like that.
Okay. And getting people in touch with how they can do it themselves.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Okay, great.
Yes.
Well, that sounds like a real winner. And now for folks who want more information, you mentioned Eventbrite. Is there a web page or someplace where they can get more information or Facebook?
Yep, go on Facebook, and you can just go on One Rhyme at a Time, and it'll bring you right to the event page. There's probably over 35 different posts that we've put up of shots that Rayanne's taken, videos we've done of us. It's almost like in the making behind the scenes of the momentum of us getting ready, you know, the fashion show rehearsals of getting ready for the event. So we're building a momentum and letting people know of what we're doing so they can sort of see behind the scenes. If you go on that page, it gives a little description of what it's about, all that. So go on the event page on Facebook and you'll be able to see a little bit more of in the making behind the scenes.
Great. Thank you so much for coming out and telling us about this. Hope to see you in Albany.
Thank you.
That was correspondent Steve Pierce with singer Claire Promise and photographer Rayanne Kazanecki discussing One Rhyme at a Time, and been celebrating the healing powers of arts in Albany. But for our last segment, we're joined by local peace activist Marina Mann, who is active with groups such as Women Against War. Last week, many Americans filed their tax returns. Oh, and much of our taxes, unfortunately, editorial comment, go to pay for the American military, which is by far the largest in the world, almost half of all military expenditures. Maureen, can you explain to us how much do we really spend of our tax dollars on the military?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Mark. Hello. I was just reading Mark Dahebe's article that was recently posted in Rolling Stone, and he says that not even the Pentagon itself could really tell you that because they are totally incapable. It is such a quagmire and a subterfuge themselves in any of their branches to be able to really tell you what they spend. But what we do know is that it's gargantuan. So, for example, for this current year, the base of what we're spending is $617 billion, plus another $69 billion for the overseas contingency operation. And I'm not sure if everyone was clear on this. I think I wasn't totally clear on the OCO. That's our war funding, i.e. slush fund budget, that we have been operating with to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Pakistan incursion, all of the current emergency wars that we don't declare. And basically that funding does not come from our taxes. It comes from borrowed money. So that will come from the taxes of our children and our children's children, along with the interest that we'll be paying on that, which you can imagine some estimates are as much as another, billions of dollars on top of that, ultimately over the many years that we'll take to pay it back. So it's a complicated question with complicated answers. But the Women Against War group that I work with, Pathways to Peace, has decided that we want to be able to ask and invite ourselves, first of all, and then invite our fellow citizens and our legislators to really, really begin to dig down into what we're spending for war and what that means. Because we agree with Dr. King, who 50 years ago called our military spending, and we have to think about the difference between 50 years ago and today in terms of the amount, a demonic, destructive suction tube. And we feel within that same framework that our war spending, our, quote, defense spending, which is in truth war spending, is unsustainable, it's irrational, it's self-serving, it's self-perpetuating, it's essentially existentially dangerous for us as in terms of our future, the planet's future, as a material commitment of all of our resources to war and war-making, which that budget really represents. And so we feel that it's important for us to speak out on this during this particular period of time. There is a global call to action that's been issued over the last few years. It's called Global Days of Action on Military Spending. And it was called a number of years ago again to provide people with essentially almost a month of days of opportunity to globally take a look at the issues of war spending and to speak out. In this year's Global Days of Action are occurring from April 13th, as you point out, Tax Day, the eve of Tax Day, through May 9th, when the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, which is a longstanding European-based institute, provides the information on global military spending for the year previous. And so that month of days serves as an invitation to really dig down into just what you're asking. How much are we spending and why are we spending it? And so we decided we wanted to engage in that initiative this year, our Pathways to Peace group. And so on Monday, May 6th, we are going to be standing at noon on the steps of the LOB outside, and we will be calling a press conference because, again, you call the press with the hope that the platform, as the young women speaking before me were talking about, is raised for conversation so as many people as possible can engage in this issue. So we'll be calling a press conference to talk about I guess the general theme of the Global Days of Action, demilitarize so we can invest in people's needs. And we're choosing to go to the state legislature because as we struggle as a state, as counties, as communities, as individuals, to try to fund human needs, infrastructure needs, the climate change demands, we're not really looking at what many people call doesn't this elephant in the room does not belong to any party, a bipartisan failure to truly take a look at what we're spending on quote defense spending. So that's why we're
choosing
that location.
You can allow us to ask another question.
Yes, for sure.
Can you tell us about some of the groups that track this military spending?
Some of the groups that track it. Oh, yeah, thank you. That's a great question. Yes, and for people to take a look at these groups would be wonderful. There is an institute at Brown University called the Watson Institute, and every year they do a very, very thoughtful analysis of what they call the cost of war. In addition, they're writing all the time around the related issues of cost of war. So, for example, this last year's report has a separate report on the human cost of war, and of course, that's always sitting there as something we have to constantly be looking at and really keep in front of us. But also a very thoughtful analysis of the resource commitment that ultimately our military budget represents. So the cost of war study at the Watson Institute at Brown University is an incredible resource if people want to track military spending. The War Resisters League, year after year after year, has been working to put out a pie chart that demonstrates how much of the discretionary budget, 56% I think it is this past year, of the United States budget in general goes for war spending. And that, in truth, doesn't include things like veterans, VA cost, and this interest cost that's very real, but we kicked down the can down the road. So the War Resisters League material is really invaluable for people wanting to understand. The National Priorities Project has a very, very interesting tool among many resources similar to these kind of analysis of both in-depth cost of war study as well as big picture, within the context of the whole U.S. budget. But one of the things they provide is a trade-off counter. So, for example, you can plug in New York State and see proportionate to the amount of tax money that New York State throws into the federal budget, how much of that goes, given the percentage of discretionary expense for military defense spending, you can plug in and see that New York State spends 20.69. No, excuse me, that's not even right. New York State spends, and I thought I had it in front of me.
Well Maureen, we have 90 yes. seconds left. So in the last 90 seconds, how much have we spent so far in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? What have we gotten for that spending? And how can people get more information in about 40 seconds?
Okay, we have spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan $5.9 trillion. That doesn't include the interest. Kathy Kelly was one of your guests recently. She goes back and forth to Afghanistan. She concurs with the Cost of War Project that we've gotten very little, and I know that's a very, very difficult thing for people to hear because of the cost, both resource-wise and human life-wise. But what we have is a failed state. We have women who are still without any kind of political power. We have a government that's prone to and fed by this military spending to corruption. So looking at one country, Afghanistan, and that's echoed in Iraq also. There's two reports that people might want to look at.
Maureen, we're out of time. Website or anything for more information?
Basically, if people go to womenagainstwar.org, they'll be able to see about this event. And if they go to demilitarize.org, they'll get information on this.
Thank you, Maureen, for joining us.
Thank you.
That concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm Kayla Danks. Our engineer tonight is Felix.